Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. Today I'm going to cover Ezekiel chapter 48, which I will call the division of the land and the gates of the city. This is our last chapter in Ezekiel. This is the last chapter of all the three big major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, and I will be so happy to finish. A little bit of introduction here, this chapter, as in all the chapters that describe the New Covenant Temple of Ezekiel's vision, was probably given somewhere around 573, according to Precept Austin, maybe 572. Precept Austin, I think, is usually a little bit early, a year early than a proper date, but it doesn't really matter. We know that the prophecy was given about 12 or 13 years after the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, and about 36 or 37 years before the return of the exiles from Babylon to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel. Now, in this chapter, we are going to discuss the lay of the land in this vision. We're going to see the boundaries of the 12 tribes of Israel, and we're going to see that the boundaries of Israel are much larger than Israel as it has ever been constituted, larger than in the time of Moses and Joshua, larger than before the captivity in Babylon, larger than after the captivity in Babylon. I have a map. You look at the map, you can see how the northern, northeastern, and southern boundaries are much expanded over Israel as it was constituted under Joshua. And for simplicity's sake, I'm going to call Israel as it was laid out in the times of Joshua as Joshua's Israel, and the millennial land as it is laid out here as Ezekiel's Israel. Now, in the last chapter, chapter 47, I showed how the new tribes are displaced from the position that they were in the old Israel. I will briefly mention that as I go through here today, but I've already done a more thorough job of that in the last chapter. I won't do it again. And of course, we are confronted with the perennial problem. Is this new covenant temple of Ezekiel, or as some people call it, the millennial temple? And that's fine if you believe the millennium is inter-advent between the first and second advents during the church age, but that's not what we usually think of when we say millennial, because pre-mills have co-opted the discourse. So I won't call it the millennial temple, because I believe this temple and this land are types of the new Israel, the Church of Christ. Now, some people say that Ezekiel's vision of the land here refers to converted Jews at the end of the church age, referring to Romans 11. I don't know why I just converted Jews. How about the whole Church of Jesus Christ, converted Jews and converted Gentiles? Now, in my humble opinion, the parts that may be construed as literal in this vision are to give continuity to the old Israel. That's one objection to the figurative interpretation of Ezekiel's vision, is that so many of the aspects of Ezekiel's vision are quite literal, but then you try to interpret everything literally and you come up with crazy boundaries, all kinds of difficulty. You end up with sacrifices and the millennium, which is crazy because Jesus has already sacrificed himself long before the pre-mills millennium. So you got problems either way, but in my opinion, the way I handle the literal aspects of Ezekiel's vision is that Ezekiel is trying to show both continuity and discontinuity. He's trying to show that the new Israel is continuous with the old Israel. It grew from the same root, if you will. The old Israel morphs into the new Israel. But he's also trying to show discontinuity. He's trying to show that the new Israel is a brand new thing from the old Israel, even as the new covenant church is a brand new thing from the old covenant of Moses. So we begin now with a description of the boundaries. At the northern frontier, Dan will have a portion. Now, I really don't want to read verses 1 through 6. It just says, Dan will have a portion, Asher will have a portion, Naphtali will have a portion, Manasseh will have a portion, Ephraim will have a portion, Reuben will have a portion, and Judah will have a portion. Let me mention just a few geographical matters as we go through. Dan has a portion, will follow the Hethlon road to Lebo Hamath. Hethlon is at the very, very northern end of Israel. And when I say Israel, I mean Ezekiel's Israel in present-day Lebanon, fairly close to the Mediterranean Sea. And the Lebo Hamath, which might be translated to the entrance of Hamath, because Hamath was a famous ancient city on the Orontes River, even further north of Hethlon, up there in present-day Lebanon. Now, Hethlon and Lebo Hamath were not a part of Ezekiel's visionary Israel, but that's the northern area. Lebo Hamath is right on the border of Ezekiel's Israel, according to my map, but some people say, like the NIV, that Lebo just means to the entrance of Hamath, whatever. These places are way up to the north. Now, in verse 1, Dan's border runs from the east side to the west side. So do the borders of all the 12 tribes, because that's one peculiarity of these 12 tribes, is they are basically rectangles, or parallelograms, if you want to look at it that way. 12 of them. Actually, 11, because the priests have their own special portion. But all the rest of them are just rectangles laid north to south on top of each other, which is absurd, if you want to take it literally. They all have equal portions to show that every tribe, tongue, and nation in the new Israel, they're equal. They have equal access to the salvation of Jesus Christ. As one of my commentators suggested, and I believe that's good symbolism. Now, Dan has the first portion assigned to it. This is interesting because it was last in Joshua's time. Joshua gave Dan a portion that was down on the coast of the Mediterranean in the Shephelah. It wasn't big enough, so then Joshua gave Dan an area way to the north. Dan is actually left out in Revelation chapter 7 in a list of the tribes because Dan had fallen into idolatry. But here in the new Israel, in Ezekiel's Israel, Dan has an equal place with all the other tribes. Sort of interesting. Now, its place was at the extreme north, both in Joshua's Israel and Ezekiel's Israel. The extreme north was the least honorable place, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, because it had so long been semi-heathen, getting up there near Baal and Astarte's stomping grounds. But, of course, it's not going to be heathen in Ezekiel's Israel. Judah is mentioned. It has the place of honor near the center, on the northern side of the center of Ezekiel's Israel. Benjamin has the corresponding place of honor next to the center on the south. Notice that the north-south positions of Judah and Benjamin are reversed from Joshua's Israel. In Joshua's time, Benjamin was to the north of Judah, and Ezekiel's vision, Judah is to the north of Benjamin. In Ezekiel's vision, Judah is to the north of Benjamin. Now, why are these two tribes given the place of honor next to the center? Because of those two tribes' long-time adherence to temple ordinances and to the house of David. Basically, those were the southern kingdom of Judea. Asher is mentioned. No one of note from Asher is mentioned in the Old Testament. That's why we don't hear too much about Asher. Interestingly, Anna in the New Testament was from Asher. In Ezekiel's Israel, Manasseh, which is mentioned in verse 4, is not split up like it was in the Old Testament. You had East Manasseh and West Manasseh, East Manasseh being in the Transjordan region to the east, West Manasseh being to the west of the Jordan. Ephraim is mentioned in verse 5, now in the Old Israel. Ephraim had two dependent tribes, Manasseh and Benjamin. It held preeminence over them. In fact, Ephraim is the short name for the northern kingdom of Israel after the split. Reuben is mentioned in verse 6. Now, Reuben was doomed formally for his incest and instability. He was not going to excel, even though he was the oldest of Jacob's 12 sons. We read in Genesis 49:4, turbulent as water. This is Jacob giving his blessings to the 12 sons, 12 patriarchs. Turbulent as water, you will no longer excel, because you got into your father's bed and you defiled it. He got into my bed. Ooh, a serious business. We read about that in Genesis 35:21-22. Israel set out again and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine Bilhah, and Israel heard about it. Well, Reuben has an equal portion in Ezekiel's vision. All the sins, all the inequality is wiped out in Ezekiel's vision. In the past, no distinguished prophet, priest, or king had come from Reuben, even though Reuben was the oldest son. In fact, Dathan and Abiram, the two famous mutineers on the Exodus, they came from the lineage of Reuben. But all of that is history. Now in Ezekiel's New Israel, every tribe has an equal portion. Now we go to Ezekiel 48:8-12. I think I'll read this. This is the description of the so-called special gift or special portion. I think it was called the holy portion in chapter 45. I can't remember, but it's real clear what we're talking about here. Bordering the territory of Judah from east to west will be the portion you are to present as a special gift. It will be 25,000 cubits wide, and I'll just summarize also, it will be 25,000 cubits north to south. Wide means east to west. And 25,000 cubits north to south. Those are perfect square. Now, this special gift consisted of Levites, priests, and ordinary people that belonged to the city. The city's not named. We'll assume it's Jerusalem. So we have a square right down near where the old Jerusalem was. It's 25,000 cubits square. Now, if you take the land from the left of that square and run it all the way, I say to the left, I mean to the west of that square, and run it all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, that belongs to the prince. We've talked about the prince in previous chapters. I have taken the position that the prince refers to Jesus the Messiah. And if you look to the right of that 25,000 cubit square, you will see land that goes all the way to the eastern boundary. That also belongs to the prince. And if you go from the eastern boundary to the western boundary of that portion of land that I've just described, it's the same size as all the other tribes. In the center of this special section is the sanctuary. That's the temple. In verse 9, the special portion you are to offer to the Lord will be 25,000 cubits long and 10,000 cubits wide. Now, I'm going to divide the 25,000 cubit square up north to south. The first 10,000 cubits to the north belongs to the Levites. The next 10,000 cubits to the south belongs to the priest, in the middle of which is the temple. And the last 5,000 cubits to the south of the portion, all of this is sandwiched between the prince's land to the east and the west. We go to the 5,000 cubit rectangle at the south, and that's the city right there in the middle of that rectangular portion. To the east and west of the city are storage facilities for food. Now, in the middle slice, going from north to south, that belongs to the priest, as I said. And in verse 11, we are informed that the priests are called the Zadokites, who were faithful in serving God, who did not go astray as the Levites did when the Israelites went astray. Now, we need to go into some Old Testament history here. Aaron had four sons who could have inherited the high priesthood. Nadab and Abihu got themselves killed for offering strange fire. That left Ithamar and Eleazar. The line of Ithamar inherited the high priesthood. That went all the way down to Eli, who was also from the tribe of Ithamar. And then Eli's sons passed on the high priesthood till it got all the way down to David's time to a priest named Abiathar. Now, Abiathar was the sole survivor of the massacre of the priest at Nob, when Saul decided he was going to kill all the priests because they had helped David when he was hungry. One priest survived, and that was Abiathar. David took him with him on his exile in the south. When David took over the kingship, he appointed Abiathar as the high priest. Abiathar was faithful to David until the very end, when it was time to pass the kingdom on to David's son Solomon. There was a rebellion, if you recall, Adonijah's rebellion, and Abiathar went with Adonijah instead of with David and Solomon. Solomon, when he took control, was not happy, and so he booted Abiathar from the high priesthood and appointed Zadok. Now, Zadok was from the lineage of that other surviving son of Aaron, Eleazar. So the priesthood passed from one family to the other. Abiathar's expulsion from the high priesthood fulfilled the prophecy on Eli when God said, there's going to be a curse on your house forever because of what your two worthless sons have done. But the Zadokites remained faithful to God. They didn't go with Adonijah. They stayed with David. And so this is what's being referred to here. The Zadokites were faithful in serving God. It did not go astray as the Levites did when the Israelites went astray. That's referring to when Abiathar tried to go with Adonijah instead of with David. So this special gift, it's called in verse 12, this 25,000 by 10,000 slice of land borders the territory of the Levites to the south, it does, in that little square, that sacred portion in the middle of Ezekiel's Israel. Let me read you where Solomon replaced Abiathar with Zadok, 1 Kings 2:35. Then the king appointed Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, in Joab's place over the army, and he appointed Zadok the priest in Abiathar's place. Now, Zadok comes from the Hebrew word for righteous, tzaddik. And so, Zadok was a type of Christ. Zadok was typical of the Christian priest who ministered to the new Israel, the church. So we got a bunch of Zadokites, perfect symbol for Christians who are now priests in the new Israel, the new church, the new covenant. These faithful Zadokites are described by the commentator Ellicott. He said they are here described as those who continued faithful in the general apostasy. And it is probable that Ezekiel uses the term in this sense. As Zadok had continued faithful in the rebellion of Adonijah, when even the high priest and lifelong friend of David went astray, and that's Abiathar, lifelong friend, been with him from the get-go before David was even king. That's pretty sad. So all the faithful priests in the time of apostasy were called sons of Zadok. Let me read you 1 Kings 1, 7 through 8. He, that's referring to Absalom, David's son, conspired with Joab, son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest. They supported Adonijah. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Rei, and David's warriors did not side with Adonijah. Zadok did not side with Adonijah, but Abiathar did. Wikipedia's description of this says that Zadok remained faithful to David. Zadok remaining faithful to David. So that's a pretty clear allusion. We go now to Ezekiel 48, verses 13 through 14. Alongside the territory of the priest, the Levites will have an allotment of 25,000 cubits long and 10,000 cubits wide. Its total length will be 25,000 cubits and its width 10,000 cubits. They must not sell or exchange any of it. This is the best of the land and must not pass into other hands because it is holy to the Lord. Now the priest 25,000 by 10,000 section was right in the middle of that carved out special place near present Jerusalem. The Levites had a 25,000 by 10 cubits wide section to the north of the priest section. They are told they must not sell or exchange any of it because it's not to pass into secular hands. It belongs to God. It's holy to the Lord, set apart for the Lord. We go now to Ezekiel 48, verses 15 through 20. The remaining area, 5,000 cubits wide and 25,000 cubits long. All right, again, think of this central special portion in the middle there near the northern tip of the Dead Sea, near where present-day Jerusalem is, going from north to south in this 25,000-cubit square. The first 10,000 cubits belong to the Levites, the second 10,000 cubits belong to the priest, and the last 5,000 cubits belong to the city. This 5,000-cubit-wide section will be for the common use of the city, for houses and for pasture land. Now notice, we have the temple in the priest portion to the north, right in the middle of the square, and then we have the city to the south. This is not normal. A temple is always in the middle of the city, not to the north of it. Again, this is symbolic. It's not meant to be taken literally in all of its particulars. So in the middle of this 5,000 cubit wide, 25,000 cubit long section, we have the city. Now, the city is only 4,500 cubits square, so to the left of that little square and to the right of that little square in the 5,000 cubit wide rectangle is land that is 250 cubits wide on each side, used for pasture land. So if the city is 4,500 cubits wide and you add 250 cubits on the east and west for a total of 500 cubits of pasture land, that's 5,000 going east to west. Well, we know that the whole section from east to west is 25,000 cubits. Well, the remaining area in verse 18 tells us there will be 10,000 cubits on the east side, 10,000 cubits on the west side. 10,000 plus 10,000 is 20, plus 250 pasture land is 20,500, plus 4,500 is 25,000 cubits. So all the numbers add up. And if you go in north to south, 4,500 plus 500 north and south for pasture land, that's 5,000 cubits, which of course is how tall, how north to south that city square is, 5,000. So all the numbers add up. Verse 19, the workers from the city who farm it will come from all the tribes of Israel, all the tribes. Everybody in Israel is going to be able to get into the city, the New Jerusalem. I think that's symbolically important because everybody is going to be coming into the kingdom of Christ. Verse 20, the entire portion will be a square, 25,000 cubits on each side. And of course, a square gives us the idea of perfection, even as the New Jerusalem in the book of Revelation was a perfect cube. As a special gift, you will set aside the sacred portion along with the property of the city. Now, a little bit earlier, I might have fuzzed the definition of sacred portion up a little bit. Here in verse 20, the sacred portion means the portion allocated to the priest, maybe to the priest and the Levites, I'm not sure. The property of the city is considered to be separate from the sacred portion. But the symbolism is obvious. The city here, in the last 5,000 cubit wide section, is the Church of Christ. As John Gill says, this city signifies the gospel church, often compared to a city in Scripture. Note how the city is outside the temple area, to the south of it. The city is to the south of the temple. This shows how idealized Ezekiel's temple is. I mentioned this earlier. Temples are almost always inside a city. Now we turn to Ezekiel 48, verses 21 through 29. I will only read you verse 21 of this section. What remains on both sides of the area formed by the sacred portion and the city property will belong to the prince. The sacred portion, of course, is the rectangle that belonged to the Levites, and the rectangle that belonged to the priest, and the skinny rectangle that belonged to the city. But all of that section does not take up the whole east-west extension of an allotment. Each east-west extension was a tribal allotment, but this little sacred portion is in the middle of such an allotment that runs all the way to the Mediterranean Sea and all the way east to the Jordan River or to the Dead Sea. Now, who owns all this land to the east and west of the sacred portion in the city in the middle? Well, that belongs to the prince. And as I said in an earlier chapter, I believe the prince is the Messiah. His portion surrounds the Levites, the priest, and the temple, and the people in the city. This is a good picture of Messiah Jesus taking care of his people, as one of my commentators says. Now, in verses 22 through 29, we have other tribal allotments: Judah, Benjamin, Simeon, Zebulun, Issachar, Gad, many of which are totally out of the positions they had during Joshua's time, during the time that Joshua allotted the tribes. Gad ends up all the way in the south. Gad was in Gilead to the east of the Jordan River in Joshua's time. Now it's almost down in Egypt, in the Negev Desert. Zebulun is just to the north of Gad. It's way down next to the Wadi El Arish, the border of Egypt, down there in the desert. Whereas in Joshua's time, Zebulun was to the southwest of the Sea of Galilee. In verse 28, the southern boundary is mentioned. I have already gone through that in the previous chapter as we talked about the southern boundary, but it ran south from Tamar, which is probably in the salt flat to the south of the Dead Sea, then running west as we head toward the Mediterranean, we get to Kadesh Barnea, which is called Meribah Kadesh by Ezekiel. Meribah, the waters of struggle and strife, where Moses struck the rock when the people grumbled, you recalled. And then you keep going west, you get to the Wadi El Arish, the Wadi of Egypt, the boundary of Egypt, and then you get to the Great Sea, that's the Mediterranean. Verse 29, this is the land you are to allot as an inheritance to the tribes of Israel, and these will be their portions, declares the Sovereign Lord. So that's the summary of the tribal allotments. Now we go to the gates of the city in verses 30 through 35, and we will be finished with Ezekiel chapter 48, and we will be finished with the entire book of Ezekiel. These will be the exits of the city, beginning on the north side, which is 4,500 cubits long. The gates of the city will be named after the tribes of Israel. The three gates on the north side will be the gates of Reuben, the gate of Judah, and the gate of Levi. On the east side, which is 4,500 cubits long, will be three gates: the gate of Joseph, the gate of Benjamin, and the gate of Dan. On the south side, which measures 4,500 cubits, will be three gates: the gate of Simeon, the gate of Issachar, and the gate of Zebulun. On the west side, which is 4,500 cubits long, will be three gates: the gate of Gad, the gate of Asher, and the gate of Naphtali. The distance all around will be 18,000 cubits. That number adds up. 4,500 times 4 is 18,000. And by the way, cubits is supplied by the translator. This is the NIV translation. The original does not have units. I've already talked about this in a previous chapter. Gill says it's not cubits, but it's reeds, which would make the circumference of the city 18,000 miles. A reed is 6 cubits. That's absurd. Gill says this shows that the temple is symbolic, not literal. I don't think we need any extra evidence for that. I don't think we need to posit that the measurement is reeds instead of cubits. The translations differ. The American Standard Version has reeds. The NASB, ESV, New King James, New Revised Standard Version have cubits. The King James has measures. The Holman Christian Standard Bible has miles. The Third Millennium Translation has measures, all of which is speculation. There are no units. Doesn't matter. Notice the city is 4,500 cubits square, as I've just mentioned. Notice there's three gates on each side, just like the New Jerusalem in the book of Revelation. Gates are open all the time. It doesn't say they're open here. But the implication is the gates are open so that all the people of all the tribes, standing for all the new tribal divisions of the new Israel, the church, all of them can come into the city, the New Jerusalem. Now, what's the name of this city? Verse 35. And the name of the city from that time on will be The Lord Is There, Yahweh Shema. Adam Clark says of Yahweh Shema, the Lord is there. This is an allusion to the Shekinah, or symbol of the divine presence, which was in the first, that's Solomon's, but most certainly was not in the second, Zerubbabel's temple. But Ezekiel tells us that the divine presence should be in the city of which he speaks, and should be there so fully and so powerfully that it should give name to the city itself, and that the very name, Yahweh Shema, should remind all men of the supereminently glorious being who had condescended to make this city his habitation. So notice that even Adam Clark says that the city refers to the Church of Christ, even while Clark at the same time maintains that Ezekiel's temple was meant to be actually built, which in my humble opinion is absurd. But even though he says that the city refers to the Church of Jesus Christ. It's the New Jerusalem, folks. Now, as I said earlier, these 12 gates around the four sides of the city show that all true Israelites have entrance into the city of God. John Gill says that these 12 gates are symbolic of the right of all of spiritual Israel to enter the church. The arrangement of the gate shows that physical Israel is not meant. For one thing, the arrangement of the gates is different than how the tribes camped in the wilderness with the tabernacle. The arrangement of the gates is different than how Joshua placed them in the land of Canaan, the tribes. No order is observed. Dan is in the middle, unlike when the land was divided at the first of the chapter where he was first. You can make no pattern out of those gates. This is one more example of continuity and discontinuity between Old Israel and New Israel. You have the names of the tribes. That reminds us of Old Israel, but they're all different in the New Israel. This is the New Jerusalem. Even though the name is not explicitly given by Ezekiel, but the location, if you look at the map of Ezekiel's New Covenant vision, it's right where the Old Jerusalem was. The symbolism is obvious to those who have eyes to see. I love Ezekiel. He's talking about the church, folks. He's not talking about some mythical millennium in the far distant future. He's talking about the millennium that is the church. The church age, the inter-advent millennium between the first and second comings of Jesus Christ. And ladies and gentlemen, on that note, we have now finished Ezekiel 48, and we are ready to jump ahead into the book of Daniel, that great prophetic book of 12 chapters. We're going to have a good time with this one. I hope you stay with me as we begin Daniel in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed the book of Ezekiel.